Hey Ding Dongs, I'm Jamie.
I'm Richard.
And this is Explain It to Jamie, the political comedy podcast in which I, Jamie, a politically innocent but curious young man, have the complicated political happenings of the world explained to him by his politically savvy friend, Richard Lamb.
Except today, we're also welcoming back for the third time, Thomas and Anthony.
Hey, more politically savvy friends. Hey guys.
Hey, dudes.
Nailed it.
Thank you. Yeah, I've been prepping that one.
That was yes. Anthony, just so you all know. And Thomas's voice sounds like...
Hello, this is Thomas's voice.
Great.
You get the idea.
We're off to a great start.
Yep. Okay, so Jamie, what is it that you want to learn about today?
Neoliberalism.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Oh, man. The elephant in the room.
That's right.
This was an oft-requested episode because I talk about neoliberalism a lot and reference it, but it's super, super hard to define, yeah. Which is actually one of its defining characteristics. It's a term that comes up a lot, primarily from people who are on the left, who are talking about neoliberals, which are not leftists. But we'll get into all this. And thank you to all of our listeners who requested it. We appreciate your confusion. And trust me, Jamie shares it.
Oh, yes. Definitely.
What about you guys? You guys got any preambulatory words to say about neoliberalism?
I just, it was for a long time, I just sort of, read the word neoliberalism, and I was like, oh, liberalism, that's probably a good thing, and they just kept going, mm-hmm. And it was actually much later in my political awakenings that I was like, everyone I respect seems to hate this thing, what is it?
Right.
So the stage, if anyone is at that stage right now, you're rocking it. You know, this is life.
About 45 minutes to an hour from now, we can all hate it together.
And we will.
And we will. Hit the theme song! Woo! Cool!
Yeah. Rev that theme song, bike. Rev it good.
Let's
peel out.
Yeah.
Okay, so Jamie, what do you know about neoliberalism?
I know that it is a very impressive word that a lot of people say in a way that makes me think that they want to seem smart in that moment. Disagree with me, assholes.
You're not wrong, that's the podcast.
You are 100% correct.
You know it now, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it. That's sort of all I know. I know a lot of a lot of modern day politicians are neoliberals, something to do with open market capitalism, libertarian freedom of being a bad person economically. But yes. That's sort of what I know.
Yeah. Okay. I mean. Yeah, you're right about the things you just said, basically.
Uh-huh.
Killing it so far.
Neoliberalism is a term that comes up a lot, especially online, and especially when you're hearing stuff said by the left about the center and the right, and even the center-left. Anyone who's right of the left often gets shot with the neoliberal cannon,
right.
As a label. The truth is, it's kind of hard to define for a number of reasons. The main reason being that at different times in the history of the 20th century, it's kind of meant slightly different things. It also, it refers to a way of thinking about the world, an ideology. There's a neoliberal ideology. It refers to specific policies that are enacted by governments and politicians that are neoliberal. And it also talks about a global state of affairs, a large global state of affairs. The relationships, the economic relationships between countries are also can be described as neoliberal. So that's part of what makes it confusing, too, is that there's all these different levels that people use the word on, and it kind of means a little bit of a different thing in different contexts. The honest truth is, it's kind of a shitty word because it's long and complicated. It's like seven syllables long, and it's just not that evocative.
Hold on, let's give everyone a second to count the syllables in their head.
Story checks out. Man, I was sweating. My butthole was clenched tighter than when I was in the scary back room in the American border trying to go work in New York this summer. Right. Fortunately, they didn't find all the tree frogs I had stashed up there.
That's free, tree frogs. Be free.
Yeah, just releasing them into the ecosystem. Mm. Just to see what happens.
Yeah. It's the second time someone's brought up tree frogs in my life today, and so one more and it gets weird.
Yeah, man. Tree frogs. That's how we're going to bring Sharia law about. Haven't you been reading the Qurans I've been sending you?
The
hastily edited secondhand Qurans.
That's right. Okay, so what the fuck is neoliberalism? Neoliberalism is the capitalist status quo. That's the simplest thing I can say about it that will start this conversation.
The modern capitalist
status quo that we have is neoliberalism. Uh-huh. And what that also means is, you remember, Jamie and I read for a discussion group that's in Toronto this book by this guy named K-Punk called Capitalist Realism. And one of the things K-Punk says is that capitalism is so ubiquitous and we're so surrounded by it, we become so used to it that we can't possibly conceive of a different way of living our lives anymore. Mm. And essentially, neoliberalism describes all the invisible assumptions about our world that we can't see anymore. The things that are the ideology, the capitalist ideology that guide our modern world, that are kind of invisible to us. Those are what people are talking about when they're talking about neoliberalism.
Like when a deer stands in the headlights of a truck, it can't possibly conceive of what is about to happen.
Yeah, exactly. Or rather, like the classic example is, this comes from a David Foster Wallace valedictorial speech, but there's this like this thing where there's two young fish. It's like an anecdote. There's two young fish swimming along, and they pass an older fish swimming the other way. And the older fish says, "Morning, boys, water's nice today." And the two young fish swim along for a little bit. And then one of them turns to the other and says, "What the hell is water?"
Right.
Right? Neoliberalism is the water that we swim in. Mm. Right? It's a political ideology that guides tons of what happens in our modern world. And yet, the people who follow it refuse often to admit that they follow a single ideology and don't consider themselves adherents of a single ideology, at least in public.
And they don't realize that we could be swimming in all kinds of stuff.
Like you can swim in all kinds of
liquids. How many minutes do we go before we go to the pee joke?
I think that was like 1 minute. No, it was like 4 minutes.
Yeah. Damn it, we're getting slower.
Okay, does that make sense so far?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so, boys, you got anything to hop in on right here?
Neoliberalism started... Brief history of neoliberalism.
Brief history of neoliberalism. So, first of all, the root word liberalism, right? That was an old political ideology that started flaring up kind of in the 1700s.
Yeah.
And really started taking root in France and America in the late 1800s, and then in the late 1700s, the rest of the world kind of through the 1800s, early 1900s. And that was replaced by a different consensus. Neoliberalism was kind of a return and a remix of those ideas of individualism, of free market economy, but with a couple different focuses, a focus rather than on production, instead on exchange and demand. And that started taking place really in the late 1970s during the oil crisis.
So like hot pause. The original liberals, what are called classical liberals now, basically invented the idea of private property. Like this was the intellectual revolution of the time. Because back in the day, all this shit belonged to like the king or whatever, and you just lived on it and he could do whatever he wanted with it. It was like the first philosophy about what made something someone's property. This was classical liberalism. And like an example is a guy like John Locke, who basically said that when you apply your labor to something, you essentially confer ownership onto it. If there's like a tree in a field that nobody owns, then you go to the tree, you cut it down, you make boards, you make a house. That house is yours because you applied your labor to the tree. That's like...
Mixing labor with an inanimate object creates property.
Yeah.
Is the mathematical, philosophical formula.
Anyway, so like these are like the kinds of ideas that were the very first liberalism.
This emerged just because, like, because of the emergent bourgeois class that was pushing, that was becoming a different thing, that weren't just serfs, that were something else, that were defined by their relationship to property. These sort of ideas had to sort of come out. They had to, you had to wrangle with these ideas for the first time of, like, so what does it mean for someone other than the king to own things?
Yeah. It's like people already started owning stuff, so they had to make up why that was okay.
Right.
Right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
After the fact.
So that's classical liberalism.
Yes.
Yeah. And one of the confusing things is we use the phrase liberalism, and in the United States that means left wing.
Likes gays.
Yeah.
Right.
Or
liberal liberal versus conservative. This is part of what blurs the line. It's like confusing.
Yeah.
Right? Liberal and conservative is like this
really the same word going through like 9 different topics.
Yeah. Totally.
And meaning different things.
It's this crayon ass way to look at the world too, because the words liberal and conservative, especially now, I mean especially literally today in the post-Charlottesville political landscape, those two words mean fucking nothing anymore. I don't know what either of those would mean in the modern world. You know, like those in-groups don't designate anything anymore. Anyway, but economic liberals are different than like political liberals, quote unquote. That's like, and neoliberalism, that word comes from like economic liberalism, which is what we've been talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
So the big switch was, I think it was about 1940s, 1950s, there were a couple of Austrian economists who started thinking that this whole way that people had set up the world with things like strong trade unions, things like strong governments, things like strong cooperative movements, that was limiting industry. Because industry was about the power of entrepreneurs to create great ideas and put those great ideas into the world. Mm. And so they started drafting up this idea, if we can just, there is demand in the world constantly. People want new things, people want innovative ideas, people want new products. That's always going to exist. What we need to do is change how supply works, right? So their idea was to get the government out of the way, to get organized groups like unions, like cooperatives, like community groups out of the way, and to isolate the world into individuals who can just exchange products with each other.
Right.
And so that was this idea that Friedrich Hayek was one of the first big ones. He called neoliberalism.
Yeah.
Right. So if we got government a bit out of the way, then business could be a lot better.
And the government,
a lot of other, and like anyone who functions in a similar way, anyone who functions in a restrictive capacity.
Right.
Yeah, so trade unions were part of the problem in their mind. And so are things like, regulations on safety and environmental regulations as an example.
Sure.
Anything like that.
But also borders.
Yes.
And also nation states in a way, right? And culture. That was also a problem in that any kind of isolation between languages, well, that inhibits your ability to do commerce. If someone speaks French and someone else speaks English, it's tougher to do business than if you both speak the same language.
Right.
Right. So
I see where this is going.
So the predominating economic model of the entire Western world from the stock market crash from 1929 until the 80s is Keynesianism, which we've talked a little bit about. But it's basically like the idea that the government should invest a lot in big infrastructure projects and develop the countries and spend, basically. The government
especially
should spend,
in bad times.
Especially in bad times, the government should spend money, put a bunch of people to work, and that'll get money in the economy, get stuff flowing, and that's kind of how the economy will work.
Right.
Keynesianism, this is, again, rough. I'm sure there's an economist somewhere like...
Fucking dying.
Fucking just screaming at his iPhone right now. I apologize. We're explaining it to Jamie. We're not doing our PhD thesis defense. So I mean, about the 80s is when the neoliberalism kind of begins to gain political power and gain true political power. And this is the time of like Reagan and Margaret Thatcher and Brian Mulroney. And you'll notice the big achievements of all of those people's governments are things like seriously weakening trade unions, privatizing industry. That's another big neoliberal thing. So in like, you know, certain sectors of industry shouldn't be owned by the government. They should be given to private owners who will allow those things to compete on the open market and find the best solutions for them, prevent them from being stagnant and stuff like that, right?
Trains are the big one.
Yeah.
Neoliberals don't like when governments own trains. Right. If a train starts being private, it's probably a neoliberal government.
Yeah, that's a good canary in the coal mine, you might say.
The other big thing that less so Mulroney, but Thatcher and Reagan were for, which might be a total divergent, is really stupid, pointless invasions of tiny islands. They were both big on
they
that.
Loved that.
They loved invading tiny islands.
I mean, tiny islands killed their parents in an alley outside a theater while they were children. So I
tiny
think they
islands
can be...
pulled their grandmother's eyes out with their own tiny hands.
They're flawed. They're dark. They're dark anti-heroes, Thomas.
Sometimes you gotta wait for.
I can't wait to the gritty reboot of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan's governments. It's coming out next summer, you guys. It's gonna be so shitty.
The fucking worst.
It's gonna be the worst.
Guadalupe, we hardly knew ye.
Yeah, they're rebooting Guadalupe as the big bad. No, okay, so then the next thing that happens, the next kind of phase of liberalism is the 90s, when we get dudes like Bill Clinton and Jean Chrétien, and this is kind of roughly characterized by a massive deregulation of the financial markets, right? Like, so in the 80s, you had like weakening unions, privatizing companies, and NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And now you have all these rules taken away from banks about how they can use their money and where they can send their money and things like that. This is all part of neoliberalism. Again, if you have a free trade agreement, that means that businesses can invest freely across borders, they can trade things across borders, right? And, you know, if you have less restrictions on banks, then they can, you know, use their money as creatively as possible to fund the most energized, best solutions that the marketplace can offer.
Right. If you can dream it, you can make it.
Exactly.
Right.
And then in the 2000s, everything went to complete shit. And here we are today. Like, I mean, I don't know how else to say it. Like, the neoliberal consensus... basically started to completely has begun to completely fail, to the point where many people think that neoliberalism and by extension capitalism are sort of doomed. Like the basic contradiction at the heart of this whole thing is that by privatizing things and encouraging businesses and taking as many restrictions off businesses as possible, you're going to create the best economy and the best services. But the truth is that the second you do that, the second you privatize a company, or the second you give more power to the people running businesses, they're driven entirely by a need to create profit. And that's like literal. Like a private business's goal is to create value for its shareholders, right? It's to, and not just value, but growth.
Right.
Right? So fundamentally, there's no obligation in that system to create good services, to take care of people, and to make sure that people have good lives. But that's the prevailing ideology of our time. That privatization, that neoliberalism.
Right, right. No, go ahead.
And what helps this sort of... Because you would think that a society that is... that has no motivation to provide, you know, care for its people or meaningful, you know, work or meaningful the experience of life to provide healthcare or housing or any of these things that is not required to maintain any of those things would eventually, like, would pretty quickly be like, there would be a large group of people who would be like, hey, actually, fuck this.
Right.
Part of what I think is so powerful and so pernicious about neoliberalism is that it has convinced all of those people who might be saying, hey, fuck this, to be like, oh, you're failing because you are not getting wise, or you are not getting smart and savvy and market friendly, and you are not doing the things that other people are doing that allow them to succeed.
Right.
And so that's why it's important, is like the mixture between the political stance of neoliberalism and the ideology of neoliberalism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So maybe, okay. So I'm wondering, we've already sort of said the word neoliberalism is a bit of a dangerous word because it can be sort of co-opted throughout,
yeah,
to engulf multiple things.
And let's just pause here right on that point.
Yeah.
You might have noticed the first neoliberals I mentioned are right wing, and then the second neoliberals I mentioned are considered left wing.
Yeah.
Right. So is it a left wing or a right wing thing? The answer is it's a right wing thing, and it just pulled the entire conversation into the right. Like as it became part of the political everyday, right? Mm-hmm. As it became an everyday part of our political landscape, it essentially forced the entire political conversation to the right.
Right.
And so, like the like I said, the first neoliberals were like Mulroney, Reagan, Thatcher. They are right wing politicians. The second wave of neoliberals was Bill Clinton, Jean Chrétien, Tony Blair in Britain.
Right.
And you see, and you start seeing here, this is really important too, there's a split in the neoliberals, and there's a left-right split where the left neoliberals adopt the like language and kind of shallow policy positions of like social progressivism. Mm-hmm. So they're for gay marriage. They want gay marriage to happen, or they're for, you know, like trans rights, but they're also for like deregulating all the banks and giving power to these very, very small group of rich white men,
right,
and giving them the tools to continue like complete capitalist oppression of minorities and, you know, all the kinds of oppression.
So when we say neoliberalism, are we speaking specifically, is there a gradient to neoliberalism, or are we speaking specifically only to those that are on the far edge of that spectrum?
No.
You know what I mean?
There is kind of a gradient, but it's not a gradient of like, oh, this is kind of neoliberal and this is hard neoliberal. It's more like different people participate in neoliberalism in different ways. So if you're like the president of TD Bank, you are like, you know, aggressively trying to create the conditions that allow your bank to be as powerful as possible and as unregulated as possible. Like, that's your version of neoliberalism.
Right. Because, like, you know, I myself think, like, I think there should be a maximum income that someone can make, and I think that there should be a universal basic income. Right. And, I like all these sort of socialist ideas, but I am also aware that privatization does lead to new ideas in a way that like hyper-regulated industries don't. Mm-hmm. And so like I'm wondering at what point in that belief structure do I myself become a neoliberal, or am I just
I think one thing, there's an economist named Ha-Jun Chang. He's an economist at Cambridge, and he talks about neoliberalism and how neoliberalism has become such an expansive field that there is a massive left and right wing within neoliberalism itself. And he kind of gives the example of during the 2008 financial crisis, there was a massive discussion about, should we just enforce austerity, or should we pummel in these kind of spending packages to prop up the banks, which were the major failing industries, right? Mm. So in Canada and the United States, we bailed out all the banks. Canada bailed out the auto industry, and so did the United States, whereas the entirety of Europe just enforced austerity, right? Mm. And Greece and Ireland and Portugal and Italy kind of saw the worst of that. Mm-hmm. But there was no point at any discussion where anyone said, should we buy up all the homes and allow people to stay in their homes for free, mm-hmm, because they declared bankruptcy. It was completely about how do we let banks keep going,
right,
and not about how do we let individual citizens keep going, because the thought was that individual citizens, they'll find their ways to keep consuming, but banks need help. And there were right-wing people who said, banks don't need help, we can start new banks.
Right.
And the left-wing neoliberals said, we can intervene, but only for banks. And so that is an acceptable realm of debate within neoliberalism.
Right, right, right. Another common like critique phrase of neoliberalism is welfare for the rich, markets for the poor. That's like something I've heard about it. So like if you're super rich, the government will bail you out if you are in trouble. But if you're super poor, you're expected to essentially buy your way out of solutions. You're charged for your help, right?
Right, like, right, right.
Can we... Okay, I have to do this because I did this research and I just wanted to talk about it. Can we do a sidebar on the 2008 financial crisis?
Yes!
This shit sure. is stupid as hell, you guys. Okay, so we all know, I think probably, that there was a huge financial crisis in 2008.
What?
And we all...
I have a financial crisis about every 4 or 5 months.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. But we all know probably that a huge part of this was because there were like bad mortgages on homes, right? You've heard this.
That's right.
And I'd often heard, they were selling these bad mortgages and then they were betting against their own mortgages to fail, and that's part of what caused the crisis. And I was always like, okay. And I was reading about neoliberalism, because the financial stimulus, Obama's financial stimulus, is a neoliberal solution, right? It assumes we need to save these banks and give these banks tons of public money in order to exist, instead of giving that money to the people who were seriously badly affected by the crisis. So I was like, wait, I don't know what that means. How do you bet against a mortgage failing? I don't understand. And I went down this rabbit hole of trying to learn how this stuff worked. And then when I came out, I hated all banks. So here's what I learned, Jamie.
Yeah.
So these mortgages that were bad are like subprime mortgages. That's what they're called. And they're the specific kind of mortgage you can get where it's basically like there's two kinds of mortgages. There's like good mortgages and potentially bad mortgages. And in the good kind of mortgage, you have to give them all kinds of information about like how much money you make and like your previous payment histories of tons of stuff. And basically, you just have to give them tons of information that tells them how likely you are to be able to repay the mortgage. And in the other kind, it's like a low information mortgage. There's a kind of mortgage you're allowed to get where you don't actually have to give them any hard information. You just self-report. Right. Like how much money you make.
Like those money store things.
Yeah, exactly. You just tell the bank like, yeah, I make $10,000 a month. Right. You could just say that, right? So what happened was people started getting these mortgages that and totally lying about their ability to pay for them. Either to, you know, get a slightly better house than they wanted, than they could get a loan for, or, you know,
To
get a house at all.
They couldn't afford.
Exactly, yeah. And the bankers who were selling them these things knew that they were kind of shifty, but they didn't care because what banks, because of the repealment of the Glass-Steagall Act, which is a thing in that Bill Clinton repealed, which was a block on the financial industry that said they weren't allowed to like invest the money that you give them.
Right.
When that was gone, they were allowed to gamble basically with your money when it's in the bank. Oh. So what they do is they package a bunch of mortgages together. So say you have a mortgage.
Yeah.
They'll take your mortgage and they'll combine it with a bunch of other people's mortgages to make a big...
I just want to say it's a dream come true.
Yeah. Welcome. They package like 1,000 mortgages into like a single unit. Mm-hmm. And then they sell the unit to somebody for like a big lump sum.
Oh, yeah.
And then when you pay back your mortgage, your money actually just goes to that other person, right? Mm-hmm. So get this.
Yeah, and they sell it for less than what you bought it for, right?
No, what they'll do is they'll sell it for more than what they loaned you, but less than the total repayment value of the mortgage. So yes. In theory, with the interest and stuff, the person who buys it will in the long run get more money, but the bank still makes a little bit of a profit on it. So that's like right. One kind of shifty
thing. Yeah, it's like those debt collectors, right? That like they buy $10,000 worth of debt
right.
for $100 or
right,
whatever.
That's
and
right.
And then they just like call people and bug them into paying the debt back,
right.
Not expecting to get most of it back.
Right. So already you can see that if all the mortgages are like good mortgages, that's just kind of it's kind of still shifty, but it's a legitimate thing to do. You're sure. Just saying, hey, this is going to return this much money to you, right? And there's a bit of risk involved because if somebody gets paralyzed and can't work and they can't pay their mortgage, suddenly that mortgage, you're figuring it out.
Yes.
What they started doing was...
So if everybody pays $100,000, say I'll pay $100,000 for a house, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, $200,000
for
a house. Yeah, everyone's paying $100,000 for a house. I'll buy these 10 people's mortgages for $1 million.
Yeah.
I'll buy it for $800,000 or whatever.
Yeah, and I'll get the $200,000 once everyone's paid off.
But then when I go and collect, like, 8 of these people default on their mortgage.
Right.
And now I've only made $200,000
and you're fucked.
And I've lost $600,000.
That's right. And not only that, the bank knew all those mortgages were bad, put
yes.
them into a package, and sold them to you.
Right.
And not only that...
They mixed way too much baking powder with their cocaine.
Yeah,
and
right. Well, and not only that, get this, the people whose job it is to evaluate how good the mortgages are and give them ratings are in on it. So they're saying, these are AAA great mortgages.
Everyone's going to pay them back.
Everyone's going to have a really high likelihood they're going to get repaid. In reality, they're all bullshit, but the people who do the rating are in on the whole system. And this is the kicker. Here's the real kicker.
This is like an organized crime.
It's like the mob.
Oh, so much fun. I'm gonna kill somebody sometimes. Especially, oh my god, I'm gonna get seized for yelling like this. But oh my god, it's so much like organized crime when I kill people.
The waveform just went nuts. It but you don't like, even need to tell that because you just heard it.
It looks like a hard white line. The waveform. Okay, but get this. This is the kicker. This is the kicker.
Yeah.
The way you can bet against your own mortgages, if you're the banker and you're selling somebody 1,000 bad mortgages in a single package, mm-hmm. there's a kind of insurance you can buy on a package of mortgages. In case the whole package fails, you still get paid a certain amount. And the bankers figured out that they could get insurance policies that they held even if they didn't own the mortgages anymore. So they would.
So they're making like
yes.
mad fucking.
Yeah, they bank. Would sell you 1,000 bad mortgages, then they would buy the insurance on the bad mortgages that they just sold you failing.
And if and they fail, they have an extra incentive.
Then when they failed, they got a huge payout.
Right.
And that's why we had a massive financial crisis. Because all those people were seeking profit.
And here's the thing, is like the real fucking nail in the coffin of all of this is that they, not only was there three levels of like, I'm ready to fail because I know that I'm going to get paid anyways, mm-hmm. is like, they were ready to fail and they knew that if the bank failed, the government would bail them out.
Yes.
Like they saw this coming and they were like, oh, this is going to end in disaster, like a broad disaster, but we'll be okay. We have people there. We yeah. have people in the White House. We have people talking to these congressmen. We have people everywhere. So when this all fucking blows up...
We'll be okay.
If this blows up, we'll be okay.
Now, fellows. Surely when all this went down, a handful of people went to jail and were punished.
I think one guy went to jail.
It was one middle manager.
Yeah.
Who had very little to do with it at Bear Stearns or something like that.
Yeah. I wonder if there's a like a word for that when one person becomes the representative who takes on the punishment for a larger group of people.
Like if one guy falls for the rest of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like
there was a guy.
He was the guy who would
fall. Or it's like it's
the guy
like
who falls.
It's like if some sort of farm animal like was very good at
like, was to get him, get up to the fence yeah, and then the yeah. farmer was to shoot them yeah. or like, yeah. like they would be like, yeah, what's that?
Man. It's too bad there's no index of all the world's information we can check for this.
Oh, well. Someday. Neoliberalism will work that out.
Yeah, that's right. So that's an example of neoliberalism in the wild.
Right.
Here's another example. Like, let's talk about just like how this manifests in our daily lives. You might have been seeing, you know, we're about to have a $15 minimum wage in Ontario. Shout out to Fight for 15 and Fairness. They've been great. And this is a thing that's in the Parliament. Still might not pass, but it's looking good. And you may have noticed, I certainly have, in the Globe and Mail and on the CBC, a bunch of articles talking about how much money the companies are going to lose because of this $15 minimum wage. Right. And the headlines say things like, Loblaws is going to lose $158 million a year. Because of a $15 minimum wage. And that's what the story's about. And then in the story, the hand-wringing CEO of Loblaws says, you know, it's just, you know, it's going to cost an extra $158 million a year, and that's the prices of the groceries are going to go up because of that, right? Nowhere does it say good, because then the people who work for you are actually going to be alive to buy groceries from you. And nowhere does it say that Loblaws made, like, $800 or $900 million in profit last year, so they're going just from making $800 million in profit to making $650 million in profit, and the only change is that their employees are going to be able to afford things now.
Right.
Right. So it's the way that conversation is framed, but like that framing that it's like, oh, the businesses are going to be hurt by this, and you, the consumer, you're going to feel the increased price. That's a neoliberal attitude. Because the price is only going to go up if the Loblaws people are so determined to make more money than last year that they make the prices go up. Because they could just absorb the loss.
Right.
They could just only make $650 million in profit this year if they wanted to.
Above budget.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's also like important to say that something like the Globe and Mail is owned by, I believe, Thomson Reuters. I might be completely wrong there.
It's a post-media paper, isn't it?
National Post is a post-media paper. And so are all of the Suns and most of the
isn't
locals.
Isn't the Globe's owned by the same guy? It's just not under the umbrella?
No, Globe's a different guy.
Oh.
Where's Jesse Brown when you need him?
Yeah, Jesse Brown could break that down. But these papers are continually pursuing advertising dollars, and so it's important for them because they're not owned by, say, a trust. Like The Guardian, the Tampa Bay Herald, those are owned by trusts, right? So they're just going to do fine no matter what happens. They're actually tied to the market.
Right.
So if the market just generally does well, they're fine. If nations generally do well, those two journals are fine. Something like Maclean's gets massive subsidies, so Maclean's can just kind of keep going. But something like the CBC, which was a fully funded government body and is now a government body that has to sell advertising, has to make itself appealing to advertising bodies. So who wants to advertise on the CBC? Probably someone like Loblaws. And so if they start publishing Loblaws-friendly ideas, they're more likely to attract those ads.
Like
intersection of the media and of corporations influences how we get our media.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know what would make that a lot easier to swallow? Pepsi. Cold Pepsi.
Yeah.
Mm.
I think you mean President's Choice Tasty Cola.
Yeah. Yeah,
the no-name brand President's Choice Tasty Cola. Hi, I'm Galen Weston. When I'm standing on the top of my super yacht, which itself sails on a living mountain made of gold across a secret ocean for rich people, I think to myself, what's the future going to bring? I think to myself, how am I going to look my son in the eyes and tell him, son, we can't have third Christmas this year because the grocery clerks pried your third Christmas out of my delicately and immaculately manicured hands. The same hands that I had transplanted onto my body from an 18-year-old I got from Peru. Son, I don't know how I'm going to look my son in the eyes and tell him he's not going to have third Christmas.
Galen, look out! A whale!
Yeah, so that's like another neoliberalism in the flesh. It's just the fact that you don't even think to yourself, wait, this is bullshit. Why should I care if these fucking rich people make $150 million a year? They're still fine.
Yeah.
You know, like, but the very fact that those people aren't ashamed to write that is our neoliberal invisible consensus.
Right.
Here, another thing I really do want to talk about, guys, is the way that neoliberalism co-opts like social justice and progressive language, but then doesn't have any backup to that. So like, so stuff gets called neoliberal sometimes if it's like performatively, you know, pro-gay or pro-black or pro-indigenous, but then it has no like substance behind it. So like, because neoliberalism is very good at like signaling about progressivism, but then not delivering on it, because often actual progressivism would be an anti-capitalist thing. Like, they just require anti-capitalist policies in order to have meaningful change. And so whenever those two things actually come up against each other, a neoliberal will almost always like will always pivot and in favor of capitalism, right? Even if it means more oppression. Like a classic example is Justin Trudeau's Twitter about, you know, in how important indigenous things are, but then he's like also dissing, you know, he's saying like, what the indigenous people don't want clean water and mental health care, all they want are places to store their canoes, which is something he actually did say this year.
Fuck our stupid prime minister.
That's one of the most common ways I see the word neoliberal used is for stuff like that. It's also kind of like the idea that like your consumption, you buying stuff, is your social activism. So if it's like, the environment's a big problem, so buy Enviro Soda. It's organic and non-GMO. And it's like, oh, if I'm buying Enviro Soda, I'm helping fight climate change. And that's like a neoliberal solution to climate change, because it's like you're buying a product on the market to try to fight climate change instead of banning oil.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
insisting that we transition to an electric, a solar economy. Right? Like, the things that would actually save us.
Yeah.
that's like a, that's one way neoliberalism comes up a lot, and the kind of ways that I see it dissed a lot online.
And that's the thing is like it's not just like leftist cultural progressive views, environmentalism, LGBT rights, etc. Like these things exist on the other on the right end of the spectrum equally.
Yeah.
The thing is like neoliberalism is an ideology that is utterly without morals. And so like it's that's also true, but neoliberalism because it is a consensus economic dogma where like almost all establishment politicians sort of buy into this sort of general idea of this is how the world works, the only way they have to separate themselves is by like associating social causes with what they're like saying, like, well, this is what we believe socially because we all actually believe the same thing economically. And so the shifting away from you can never sort of talk about economic things because everyone just sort of generally agrees on the economic principles. To me, this is like we stop saying working class at a certain point in our the sort of 20th century cultural heritage,
right?
Because working class implies that there is a non-working class. There is a
which there is.
There is a non-working class. They don't work, and right. We need to
address that.
Address that. Address that is a great way to end that sentence. Thank you for offering such a good way for me to end the sentence.
Hey, it's what I do.
We talked a bit about that in our Democrats versus Republicans episode. But like, it's that. The idea that because business exerts such influence in politics, those pro-business ideas just aren't challenged by any of the mainstream politicians. And so you don't hear people saying, why don't we have... There's no one saying, why don't we have a maximum wage in Canada? And it's because of the neoliberal consensus. All of our politicians, almost, except for a select few, are neoliberals. I learned that to be in the top 1% in Canada of all income earners, you have to earn more than about $200,000 a year, right? So if you put, like Mélenchon wanted, like if you had a 99% tax bracket above $1 million, where for every dollar that somebody made after $1 million, 99 cents would go to the government, you would be taxing less than 1% of Canada, but you would generate so much money that the government could use to get those First Nations people fucking water.
And you'd still have so people who would be wealthy.
They'd still
so many canoes, which is what and Trudeau is hard
storage.
For.
Yeah. Ample storage. And then... And those people would still make $1 million a year.
Yeah.
You don't need more than $1 million a year. Well, hot take.
Oh, well, yeah. Malcolm Gladwell, who I'm now on David and Goliath, for those keeping track. I've been going through one a week. He says that after $75,000 a year, the benefit falls off on quality of life.
People just like aren't happier that much.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
It's, every, right. It's like just past $75,000 a year, which is like $75,000 a year. You can do pretty much everything you would want to do. Like you're like, do I want to take a month off and go to Peru? I can do that.
Yeah. I can go out for dinner. I can go to the movies. I can go to the play.
I never have to think about spending money. I never have to be like, can I afford avocados?
Yeah. Well, here's a digression though. Like, I actually think that there is maybe a morality. This is just a me thought. I think there maybe is something moral about the idea that a good metric for how much money a person should be able to make is like a person should never be able to never think about using resources when they do stuff.
Yeah.
Like you should probably make enough money that you can feel like you're not clawing your way to survival, but you should never be allowed to have enough that you can think, I don't care. You should always go, okay, let me just add this to the total. Okay, this is fine. Once you reach the point where you're not adding to the total anymore, I think you might be into the territory where you're so wealthy it's immoral.
Yeah, no, it's what they call a there's a reverse U curve on it, in which at a certain point there's diminishing returns on how happy your money makes you, but after a certain point it actually starts going down, and you start making so much money that it's harder to raise your kids with a realistic sense of what the world, how the world works, and how what wanting is, mm-hmm. and what, you know, how hard things can be, and too much money is actually poison for you.
Yep.
Sorry, I blacked out there for a minute. Did you say poison the very rich?
I didn't say that. But maybe we should.
Well, like you know that thing where there was that article that was like, apparently six dudes own as much money as the bottom half of the entire world's population. Did you see that article?
Yeah. Wasn't that like what the Walmart family or whatever owns? Yeah, something like the bottom 20% of Americans don't have as much money as all like these four.
The one
Whalen family. Yeah. And as I said on Twitter, and I stand by, I was like, I bet we could take them. the entire bottom half of the world's population could probably take those six people.
Yeah. They probably got some bodyguards, but there's like 3.5 billion of us, so we suit up, and I know, we can do this.
Okay, let's plug back in here to the topic. So, why do we care about this? I think we care about neoliberalism, and we need to identify it, because A, it's invisible, and B, it's failing. Neoliberalism is failing to use the market and to use business to solve the actual serious problems that we have in our world. The biggest one of which is climate change. Neoliberalism has so completely failed to create a solution for climate change because by empowering all of these companies and giving them political power and taking away the regulations, essentially oil companies have so much political power that they can't be destroyed. And we're all gonna die, or at least our like fucking grandchildren are gonna die so that these fucking people can make money in the short term. Like that's the 100% what's happening to us right now. There's so much scientific evidence that we're all gonna die because we're all using so much oil and we just can't stop using the oil because the oil companies are too strong and they resist all of our attempts to stop them.
Right.
And that's like a great reason why neoliberalism should be fought against. That's maybe enough of a reason right there. Mm-hmm. But there's, you know, many other examples of just things it's not doing well. It's not doing its job, which is to solve our problems by using the market to find the best solution. It turns out that's not actually what the incentive is. The incentive is just to make whatever dumb shit people will buy.
Yeah, I would really recommend reading that Capitalist Realism book by the guy. What's it? That guy K-Punk. It's a hard read. It's a hard
in the sense that it's like it's like devastating.
It's devastating.
Not, he writes like really. He's on your level, and he's like he's not like talking too much about
there,
you.
No, but there is a certain like he references Zizek and stuff without any explanation.
And a lot of like a lot of movies that you I read it really quickly and I had to go over bits again because I was like, okay, you lost me here. I'm not gonna look up all this shit. It's a good read.
If there is stuff in it that like doesn't make sense, you can just flip ahead to because there's sections that really aren't that dense that are really, really incredible and effective. I mean, one of my favorite things from the K-Punk book that we were just talking about is how he kind of talks about how capitalism like internalizes and then regurgitates challenges to itself. Like, especially like, you know, we love watching movies about people like beating businesses, but those movies are themselves like a capitalist enterprise. Like Hollywood is a very capitalist organization. Mm-hmm. And we feel performatively better about ourselves and about the status quo after we watch those movies because the movie has performed our anti-capitalism for us. And you can insert all kinds of potential social justice causes into whatever that blank is. Mm-hmm. And we performatively experience the feeling of changing the world through this art, but then we don't actually change the world at all. And again, it's a neoliberal thing. Everyone is an individual. Mm-hmm. Right, we don't have a class consciousness anymore. We don't have a notion of collectives. You're an individual person, and
Margaret Thatcher said there is no such thing as society.
Yeah,
is I think the clearest articulation of this idea.
Yeah, so you're an individual person, an individual consumer in the ideology of neoliberalism, and because of that, you are kind of powerless. You know what I mean? Like you feel sort of powerless, and you feel like, oh, what could I do? It's very easy to rationalize yourself out of agitating for any change because you have no collective obligations to anybody but yourself. Whereas in our grandparents' age, that wasn't the case. They didn't think of themselves that way. They weren't all considered. They didn't think of themselves purely as individuals. They had collective obligations.
You look at something like Europe, most of the cities developed a lot earlier than Canadian and American cities, right? And you look at countries like France and Germany, they'll have cities with 80 and 90% rental rates, right? Only maybe 10% of people own their own homes. Whereas even in most of the major cities in Canada, you're still looking at a lot of the time something like 30 to 40% rental rates. About 60% of people are mortgaging their homes, and they're massively overmortgaged. And you look at that same kind of statistic about how people think of themselves now as opposed to, say, 40 or 50 years ago. You look at the 60s, people thought of themselves as a special person somewhat like 10% of the time. And now over 80% of them think of themselves as a special individual. So we've atomized ourselves. People think that they're special. They think that they're a specific consumer, or they're a specific customer, or they're a specific producer. And in the olden days, or the days of the kind of social democratic consensus, people generally thought of themselves as a society where they could rent and they could work together and they could create a project together as humanity and buy things collectively.
That's very interesting, because I think we talked about in the Edward Snowden episode that it is a deep and horrifying thing to realize how much of a statistic you are.
Mm-hmm.
Like how predictable your behavior is, and how you are just sort of an ant in an anthill, and realistically very unspecial. And and it, for me, when I first heard that, it was a crazy depressing thing. But I suppose for someone in a past decade, they would have gone like, well, yeah. I'm mind you, they would be like, what is that computer you're reading?
Yeah. Get out of here, you space alien.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly.
After they've come to terms with the fact that someone's visited them from the future, yeah, they would think, yes, I am a perfectly normal object.
Yeah, and I'm like, I knew you'd be here because Google told me. Like, what's Google?
Yeah.
It's the god where I'm from.
Yeah.
Wow, guys.
It's a lot of information in your brain pan.
It's a lot of info.
Does that feel like it's shed some light on what we're saying when we say neoliberalism, though?
It does. I feel like I had a... Yes, this has certainly given a ton of context. My original definition of neoliberalism, I still feel is like pretty on the money.
Mm-hmm. That's what it was, a good one.
For a turn of words. But... yeah, yeah, this that mortgage thing is fucking horrifying.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, and this is a key thing. Like, one of the main things I think of when I've been using neoliberalism on this podcast is that it's generally speaking, it's something that happens where the average vulnerable person gets fucked and some rich dude walks away just fine, right? Like in Greece, when we were talking about Greece, in Greece, they force austerity on them. So they force them to cut all their social programs in order to try to get them out of a recession, which is a horrible idea in a recession. Now that I know a bit about economics, I've learned that many economists think that that's a bullshit idea and you should not do austerity in a recession. But that's what the EU is a super neoliberal institution. It follows there's like 10 guidelines that the International Monetary Fund has for countries, and those are almost like the closest thing you could find to a list of neoliberalism and its principles are those like 10 principles. The Washington, what the fuck is it called? The Washington Consensus?
Yeah, the Washington Consensus.
That is literally what it's called.
The World Trade Organization, the IMF,
yeah.
And the third one.
The third one, the World Bank?
World Bank, yeah.
Yeah. And anyway, so in the situation in Greece, they've forced them to cut their social programs and their spending in order to try to get them out of a recession. And that's neoliberalism, because the people who need social programs to survive get fucked. And the rich people, they're fine. The bankers, all the people who own all the companies, those people are fine. You know, in any situation, in Venezuela, when we were talking about Venezuela, it was neoliberalism in the 80s that they fought against, where the average person's life was shitty, and the very rich people were getting richer and richer. And this kind of thing has been happening across the whole Western world, right? There's a very, very elite group of people who are getting much, much, much richer than they were, the same elite group of people would have been 100 years ago. And the average person in the West, their wage is actually going down in comparison.
Right.
It's like we finally started the point where like the average person's actually making less money now than they would have been in the 50s.
Right, yeah, it's like the biggest wage gap since the 1920s.
Yeah, whatever,
right?
And that's that one statistic is neoliberalism at its core.
It's a good thing that, like, shortly after the 1920s, the market got really, really good and everyone lived happily through the 30s.
Yeah.
Nothing bad happened in the 30s.
Sure.
Yeah. And, like, as a result of nothing bad happening in the 30s, nothing bad happened in the 40s.
No.
Yeah.
Just clean sailing.
That's why we called them the 40s we forgot. I've never seen a movie set in the 40s, and I never will.
Oh, God damn it.
Yeah,
let's cut Marie Antoinette's head off again.
Is that going to work again? Can we do that?
Yeah, sure, sure. That's bound to happen, right?
Right.
I mean, probably.
Someone's going to say something, and, like, it's going to become the line.
Like, something's going to happen. All of this Nazi shit, a lot of it, I think, is... Populism comes from hard economic times, and neoliberalism completely creates... the necessary conditions for, like, fascism and angry right-wing people looking for excuses about why their lives are bad.
Right.
You know what I mean?
But refusing to, like... And, like, the left, like, looks at the situation and says, like, hey, this economic system was built to fail and built to cause... and built to shift money upwards in an ever-shrinking pyramid towards a select group of people. We need to change the material conditions that create this. We need to change how money exists. We need to change how labor exists. We need to change who has power. Because the left is not afraid to challenge the idea that capitalism works. The right, wanting to maintain capitalism as an ideology, you sort of, like, neoliberalism just has continued to fail. And so, like, it has failed so much, but they refuse to let go of the idea of capitalism.
You have to make up an enemy.
And so you have to make up an enemy.
Yeah.
And so you have to say, like, oh, capitalism would be working if it wasn't for the Mexicans who are here stealing our jobs. Oh, right. Capitalism would be working except for the bad trade deals we made with China. Capitalism would be working except
Justin Trudeau has created shirtless Sharia law, and because of that, we can't have good Loblaws anymore.
And so, you know, like, that's where fascism comes from.
Right.
Anyway.
Alright, guys, I'm getting ready to pull the ripcord on this. Let's do it. Do we have anyone want to make any closing remarks? This episode, if you want to stand up against neoliberalism, I urge you to buy Econo Soda, a soda that me and Richard make right out of our bedroom.
It'll make you so anti-neoliberal, you won't be able to handle it.
Yeah, you'll go blind.
Because there's no regulations on this soda.
No regulations on this soda. We don't even know what it is. They send it to us from Bangladesh and we don't ask questions.
Guys, thanks again for coming on the podcast. You're always welcome.
You are.
It is a joy to have you in my bedroom, in my closet.
My God. In another time, this would have been the start to, like, that's like the starting line to, like, a Tennessee Williams play.
Yeah. It's always a pleasure having you in my bedroom, in my closet.
All right, if you like this episode, if you didn't like this episode, if you've got quibbles or questions or queries, send them our way on Twitter at ExplainJamie. Or just Google Explain It to Jamie and figure it out from there.
Yeah, it's not we're on hard. Facebook, we're on Twitter.
We have a Gmail.
Throw it on the internet.
Just do it. Throw it. Scream into the void. We'll hear you.
We're listening.
Yeah, and share the podcast if you like it. It really helps us out. Who called the cops on us? Who the fuck called the cops on us? Share the podcast if you like it. It really does help us out. We appreciate it a lot. And let us know if you got ideas for other topics or anything you want us to tackle.
Yeah, also, what helps us out, if you go on your iTunes, give us a rating and give us a blissfully lovely comment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It has to be lovely.
It has to be lovely.
We'll know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Until next time, I'm Jamie.
I'm Richard.
I'm Anthony.
I'm Thomas.
This has been Explain It to Jamie.
Woo!